This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. They are overlooked. And when they are not overlooked, they are judged, condemned, and punished. They are heroin addicts living on the street in one of the wealthiest cities in the world, San Francisco. But who takes the time to learn about what homeless drug addicts experience? What kinds of relationships they form, how they are treated by law enforcement, hospitals, and other institutions, and who analyzes the structural forces that shape the lives of social pariahs like these. For more than 10 years, Philippe Bourgois and Jeff Schoenberg became part of the daily lives of two dozen homeless heroin injectors in San Francisco. Their book, entitled Righteous Dope Fiend, is a portrait of the individuals and social networks they encountered. It is also a photo ethnography of drugs, poverty, race, and social exclusion. And it's a political statement about institutions, policies, and priorities that impose a great deal of unnecessary suffering on vulnerable and marginalized populations, both in this country and abroad. Philippe Bourgois is University Professor of Anthropology and Family and Community Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and author of In Search of Respect, Selling Crack in El Barrio. Philippe, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Jeff Schoenberg is a photographer and ethnographer and a graduate student in the joint UC Berkeley and University of California San Francisco Medical Anthropology program. Jeff joins us in studio as well. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thank you.
Let's start by talking about the whole. Many of the homeless heroin injectors you got to know inhabited a place in San Francisco called The Hole. I won't ask you specifically where it is because you don't want to reveal that in this book, of course, but tell us about The Hole.
Jeff, you should go with that because you're the one that was in The Hole.
Okay, well, The Hole is a spot where it was close to one of their copping points. When I mean by copping is where they would buy their drugs. And oftentimes they would go to The Hole because it was a place where they could immediately fix or inject after copping. And it wasn't necessarily by where they lived, but a little bit further away. And The Hole was called The Hole because it was sort of this kind of this disgusting spot on the edge of the freeway. And in The Hole itself, there were, and I describe this in the book, there you would find lots of garbage, lots of feces, especially in The Hole. And like I said, it was a place that you could go and fix without, by doing it without necessarily having other people know you were doing it. And in the book, and I'm actually going to let Philippe talk about this, we talk about the running partnerships and how the men survive as homeless heroin addicts, as destitute homeless heroin addicts, of course, and access places like The Hole as a way of sort of promoting their survival.
Yeah, and what's tragic about The Hole is that The Hole is basically, the popular term for The Hole would be a shooting gallery, right? It's what we call a shooting gallery. It's an open-air shooting gallery. It's not one of the shooting galleries where you have to pay an entrance. It's basically out there for anyone that can access it. And tragically, because of how our society and public policies manage street-based addicts, that kind of absolutely filthy, dangerous space becomes, ironically or tragically, the safest place to inject heroin for a homeless heroin addict. Because what they're doing is they're fleeing the police. And this place stinks. It's really hard to get into. To the whole, Jeff has a description of it. It opens our book, actually. You literally have to, balance on an I-beam and then jump down and so forth with speeding traffic going by you, to the side. And so the police simply won't go there. It's too dangerous for them. And it stinks. The first thing Jeff did was jump into a pile of feces. Right. If you look at that from a public health perspective, there's no better place to spread abscesses, soft tissue infections, HIV, hepatitis C, than a shooting gallery like The Hole. And that's the tragedy, basically, of how our policies, this war on drugs, push people to go to the filthiest spaces as refuges where they can, you know, satisfy their addiction, basically.
We're going to talk much more about some of those larger forces. You write that these people, and I'm reading, endured the chronic pain and anxiety of hunger, exposure, infectious disease, and social ostracism because of their commitment to heroin. How strong was their commitment to heroin?
It was what allowed them to put one foot in front of the other every day. It's how they knew how they were going to organize their day. And that day was going to begin with a hit of heroin, and that day was going to end with a hit of heroin. And the time within the period between waking up and going to sleep was going to be trying to locate the resources or some way in order to get that heroin.
And tell us about heroin withdrawal and the symptoms that accompany them and why it was so important for these people to avoid withdrawal.
Heroin withdrawal is really a hideous thing to experience. It's a hideous thing to see. It's extraordinarily physically painful. Basically, what happens with opiates, with heroin, is that the proteins of your cell require the opiates in order to perform their function. And so, and that's what physical addiction is. And so what happens is all your cells just stop functioning when they stop getting the opiate, you know, I don't know what the technical terms, the opiate protein fractions or whatever they are, that make your cells operate. So you're all of a sudden, you know, you're sweating all over, you're not able to digest anything, you can't think straight, different parts of your body hurt. And so if you have feet problem, the first thing that hurts is your feet. If you have a lower back problem, that's where monkey on your back comes from, the old-fashioned term for heroin addiction. Because most of these guys traditionally were doing day labor, right? They were doing hard work, and people doing day labor hurt their backs. That's basically your occupational injury. And so that's the first thing the first symptom of heroin addiction would be a monkey on your back, pain in your back. Now it tends to go into your feet. There's less day labor available, and homeless people are running around on their feet and in pain on their feet. And the first thing a lot of people will say is, you know, my feet, my lower legs, I know I'm... But basically they start sweating, shivering, and so forth. And then the next thing you know, everything erupts. They're throwing up. They're unable to control their bodily functions. And they get a tremendous angst. I mean, they describe it as feeling like ants are crawling through your bones.
Jeff Schoenberg, I think you began to talk about this when you mentioned running partners, but you folks mention, you write in this book, that mutual solidarity is a regular part of these people's lives. What form does solidarity take? What kinds of interpersonal connections are essential to survival on the street in this context?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely essential, and we talk about in the book something called the moral economy of the homeless. Actually, why don't you talk about it, Philippe? I think.
Yeah, well, we conceive of them as a moral economy of addicted bodies. Right. They can't survive on their own as individuals, both because it's hard materially and also it's hard emotionally. They're human beings. They want to be in society. And there are a few who are just complete loners, but the vast majority crave human contact. They crave that is what sort of, on some sense, makes us humans, to want to live in society. So what they do is they're constantly exchanging, basically, gifts of tastes of heroin. They call them tastes of heroin, little tiny amounts of heroin to one another, so that they indebt each other in obligations to give one another heroin. And when you give a gift is when you see someone in your acquaintance field or your running partners who you're closest to. That's your best friend. That's who you basically share everything with. And when you see an acquaintance or your running partner starting to show physical signs of heroin withdrawal, if you want to remain on good terms with that person, it's your obligation to give them, you don't have to give them a lot of heroin, you have to give them enough to cut their heroin withdrawal symptoms. And then they can get back on their feet and go out and hustle, whatever they do, whether it's day labor, mugging someone, breaking into a car, begging, whatever it is that they do to get money. But once you're in heroin withdrawal symptoms, you can't do anything. You're basically throwing up on yourself, and you can't fine money.
And you want to do that for them because you know what, that you will need or that you might need help from them
exactly.
in the form of heroin
later?
So
that obligation then is returned. And so basically you have developed capital so that, you know, when it's an Oscar. So for example, let me just put it. So I'm dope sick and Philippe has resources. He can get me well. Now, Philippe knows, or at least he expects, that the next time that he is dope sick and I have resources, then I'm going to help him out. And so that obligation is always there. And so you always have that. You always have that waiting for you. And so theoretically, those who are the most generous find themselves the least dope sick because they are... You know, they have this stuff. They have their wellness in the kitty, okay. And so they know that eventually that it'll come back to them. Now I say theoretically because it doesn't necessarily always work that way in a perfect world.
And it's very hard to understand when you're looking at it in the street because at the same time that they're being incredibly generous to one another, they're also stealing from one another. So it's this ambiguous tightrope. Extraordinary generosity in the form that they have nothing, right? What they got is they've got their fix of heroin. They've got the $10 bag of heroin that they got. Mm-hmm. And boom, they see one of their acquaintances, not even their running partner, an acquaintance is throwing up. Boom, they'll sometimes split that bag in half. You know, when was the last time you gave away half your prized possessions to someone on the street? And then while they're giving it to them, they'll notice, you know, whatever, something that their friend has that his eyes aren't looking, they'll steal that thing and put it in their pocket while they're giving him $5, mm-hmm. you know, half of their possessions. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, mean-spirited. It's basically the nature of the logic of hustling and surviving when your primary dedication is to getting, you know, opiates into your bloodstream.
Philippe Bourgois is the name that goes with the last voice you heard. He teaches anthropology and family and community medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Jeff Schoenberg joins us as well in studio. He is a photographer and ethnographer and a graduate student at UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco. We are talking about their book, Righteous Dope Fiend, and we have a link to that book published by University of California Press on our website, againstthegrain.org. This is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. You bring up a number of thinkers and writers in this book, among them Primo Levi, a survivor of Auschwitz, who pointed out what he termed the gray zone in the death camps. Tell us what he means by the gray zone, and then I want to ask you about how that analysis might apply to the whole.
Yeah. I find the Primo Levi's concept of the gray zone very, very useful to maintain oneself vigilant in everyday life for these often invisible spaces that are spaces of extraordinary suffering that get imposed on people, where people, because of the way that suffering is imposed on them, become monsters to some extent. And he was referring to his experience surviving at Auschwitz. He was in the death camp at Auschwitz in the IG Farben factory. What he, you know, realized was that every one of one's, there was no way for people to be able to help one another without themselves dying, in some sense. There just wasn't enough to go around. So even when one was a very good, ethical, beautiful person as an inmate, one had to be making these decisions about who you're going to help, who you're going to ally yourself with, and literally walk over dying bodies as you were, you know, keeping the people that you were trying to help alive. This is in the best case situation. And the tragedy then with Auschwitz was that the Nazis managed to get the inmates to administer their daily life on the day by day amongst each other by creating hierarchies between the inmates. So the petty, the extraordinary everyday brutalities that were, literally getting people in and out of their barracks, distributing the potatoes, you know, whatever, delivering blows for that matter, were being administered by inmates themselves. And so Auschwitz is a caricature of the gray zone. So what Primo Levi tells us is that Auschwitz wasn't an exception. Auschwitz was just an extreme case version of how these kinds of institutionalized spaces have the capacity to turn humans into agents
agents of their own destruction. And so he tells us in one of his articles that we should just look at any industrial factory and treat it as a gray zone. Look at how management manages to divide workers, destroy the solidarity between the workers, destroy the unions, and make the, you know, and lead to these situations that perpetuate the social inequality and a negative experience for people at the bottom of the hierarchy. So we were then conceptualizing these homeless spaces, like the homeless shooting encampments that we spent so much time in to write Righteous Dope Fiend, as gray zones, as these spaces where the residents of these encampments, because of the way the war on drugs is organized, and also because of the nature of addiction, the physical nature of addiction, which takes over your body and really turns you into being incapable of controlling your actions in some sense. How that made them into agents of their own destruction amongst each other.
And when you think briefly, I mean, even the discussion of the whole, they weren't just hiding from the police. They were hiding from each other in their relationship to the moral economy. And so, again, they're in these spaces where generosity would allow them, hypothetically, to stay well. But yet what they're doing is they're searching for these spaces in which they could be selfish. But that selfishness is important because that selfishness allows them also to strive within their world, within that gray zone in which they're trying to succeed.
And, you know, we opened the book trying to get at that point by showing readers how that operates in action. And it's a fieldwork note by Jeff. And what in that particular moment where Jeff writes about, walking on the I-beam, jumping into the whole space, and then describes the horrible, you know, physical space of the hole. It ends with these two guys who were injecting together were actually fleeing from another guy who they knew was dope sick, and they didn't want to help him. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so they were hoping he wouldn't be able to find them, because that other guy they knew wasn't generous. So if they gave him a taste of their heroin, they didn't expect that they would get enough back from him. So people are making these decisions, sometimes consciously, sometimes not consciously, mm-hmm. that then, you know, leads to these constant multiple betrayals and very calculating, analysis of how to get over on someone.
And your discussion of betrayal and manipulation by these folks, that relates, I think, to the issue of blame, the issue of how we outsiders look at them and judge them and could justifiably blame them for their situation. And also, I think it also relates to what society encourages them to do to themselves in terms of self-blame. Could one of you talk about that?
You know, this is really the complicated crux of the matter. Mm. And that is how hard it is for outsiders to understand how it's possible for street-based dope fiends, they call themselves dope fiends, for street-based dope fiends to behave the way they do. And when you start looking at the larger structural forces, it starts to make sense to you. And also the embodied forces, just the physical addiction for that matter. And the problem with this is that precisely when you get trapped in a gray zone, you start behaving in these ways that are just horrendous, that are constantly about betraying one another. So an outsider, when they see that taking place, let's say for 10 minutes, is just disgusted by the behavior of these folks that are behaving like that. And then what happens is you get this dynamic of what this French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu calls symbolic violence. You get this dynamic where it looks like it's the fault of the addicts that they are in such horrible situation. And it blinds you to seeing the structural forces that is turning the addicts into these little mini monsters with one another. And so that's what's so hard for people to understand, and what's so frustrating also often for people who work in treatment or something like that, who are trying to help addicts deal with their problems, or people that are working in housing trying to help addicts. They'll see them failing, and they'll start blaming the individual for their failures because you can't see structural forces. You see the individual actions that are making someone, you know, steal something from their neighbor and get thrown out of the house, the assisted living situation, and so forth. And but you don't see the addiction, you don't see the whole structure that's forcing people to become monsters.
And not only do you not see it, of course, you can't touch it. You can't touch those structural forces. They're not in front of you, just the way we're talking. And you know, and I. So where can I place my blame? Am I going to start going on a political rant at that moment? Seriously. And so where else is it going to go? And so again, I mean, I think the gray zone is just a great way to contextualize it. So here we have people, and I think your example of treatment is really important because you know, someone who's in treatment talking with their counselor, they're usually in solidarity. But here's a moment where something like the gray zone, right, is forcing that solidarity apart because of, say, these structural forces, which are being placed in between them. It's just there's nothing to really grasp that.
Okay. We're going to have a lot of time. I'm hoping we'll have a lot of time to discuss those structural forces in some detail. Jeff Schoenberg is a photographer and ethnographer. Philippe Bourgois is Richard Perry University Professor of Anthropology and Family and Community Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Their book, which is a photo ethnography based on more than 10 years of following more than two dozen homeless heroin injectors in San Francisco, is entitled Righteous Dope Fiend. There are some interesting racial differences, ethnic disparities among the behavior and conduct of the injectors you observed and spent time with. How did the African Americans and the whites who you dealt with, how did they differ in terms of their drug habits and in terms of the way they represented themselves?
You know, at first sight in San Francisco, sometimes you think that a street corner where drugs are being sold and consumed looks like sort of a multicultural, you know, just panoply of people, and that drugs are this place that level everyone and put them all on an equal footing and so forth. And you literally see that, you know, at drug copping corners and so forth. But what we discovered very fast was that even though the African Americans and the whites were sharing the exact same spaces, were sharing the same drug, often sharing the paraphernalia to prepare the drug together, they were having a very different experience of the drug itself. And this had become embodied in how they were just interacting on an individual level and how they were feeling their high even. And so what we realized is we really have to, you know, get at this, figure this out, because it has nothing to do with race in a you know, biomedical term. That's not what's going to give you a different relationship to physical addiction and so forth. What it has to do is precisely with these larger structural forces that set up these different options for people based on the color of their skin and based on their ethnic identity with the color of their skin. We call it racialized ethnicity. And so basically, in a nutshell, the whites basically had the option of panhandling relatively easily. They could stand on a corner and raise enough money to stave off their withdrawal symptoms by politely asking passersby for change most of the time, not all of the time. Some days, boom, they were stuck, dope sick, you know, and in trouble. For African Americans, passive, you know, quote unquote, friendly, passive panhandling is much more difficult. They scare people. People, the structure of racism and this, just the way people's reaction is, boom, when they would fly, they call it flying signs at the entrance to freeways. You know, when they have that sign that says, hi, homeless, mm-hmm. you know, God bless, mm-hmm. Vietnam vet, please help, you know, want food. You know, when an African-American flies that, people will press their window and, you know, button and raise the window and so forth. And so what they tended to do, not all of them, but most, was to reject that
And say, no, begging is for losers. I am going to take what I can get. I'm going to maintain my dignity. And those whites just lack initiative. All they do is sit on the corner and fly signs and beg. I am a hustler. I am going to embrace this. And so they're not aware that it's a conscious rejection. But when you look at it closely, you start seeing that they simply don't have the choice to panhandle. When they did panhandle, what they had to do was bring a hustle into it. So they would do it like with a rhyme, cracking a joke. When the whites panhandled, it was like eyes on the ground. I'm just, broken down. I'm not threatening. Please help. Please feel sorry for me. I'm basically a wino and so forth. And whereas the African Americans would either panhandle aggressively or provide a service, clean the window on the car, crack a joke, or say, hey, what's the matter with you? Why aren't you giving me money? Are you racist? What's your problem? Give me money. And so it creates these feedback loops that then get things even worse, of course. Now, the other thing is whites and African Americans had a very different relationship to law enforcement. Law enforcement treats people very differently based on the color of your skin. Basically, it's on some level, it's often a common sense to people. But when you really see that playing out on the streets. So, the police were more aggressive with the African Americans. And that creates its own feedback loops where then the African Americans would be more oppositional to the law enforcement officers. And you get these cycles of getting arrested more because you don't put your beer can in a paper bag because you're angry and you want to show that you have control of your space, and boom, you're not scared of the police, et cetera. Boom, that gets you a ticket, which then gets you a warrant, which then gets you locked up for violating your bench warrant.
And so so going back to just the relationship between, their injection practices in and of itself. And so even in that, the whites who, we talk about seeing themselves as these sort of broken down, very depressed winos, would inject their heroin through their muscle, through their fatty tissue. And what the heroin does is it slowly releases itself into the blood system. While the African Americans, and let me step back a sec. So a majority of the members of the community who were here, we were hanging out with were shooting drugs on average already 20 some odd years when we had met them. Mm. And so they had all very much, when you inject heroin into your vein, eventually your veins will scar. And you literally, you can't get the syringe in there and you can't, what they call mainline, your heroin. And so the white members of the community would say that their veins were all scarred, their veins were dead, and they could no longer inject within their veins. Well, and so what they would do is they would then muscle in their fatty tissue. It might be in the top of their shoulder, might be in their buttocks. While the African Americans would actually spend time shooting and searching for the vein that they can then mainline into. And because in that process of searching for that vein, when they mainline, they're going to get an immediate rush from the injection of the heroin, and they're seeking that rush. And all the addicts would love to get that rush, but the African Americans spent time searching for that rush, even though they were dope sick. They were willing to
take literally 45 minutes to find a vein, mm-hmm. Injecting between their toes and little tiny capillary type veins. And so what happens is that then becomes your relationship to heroin. Mm-hmm. For the African Americans, it was, I'm enjoying this. For the whites, I'm sick and I'm just getting well. I need my heroin to function. Right. And when they were young, they were all injecting directly into their veins. And all of them started losing their veins. And then that option of becoming a broken down wino who's depressed works for the whites in some sense. And whereas that option does not work for an African American on the streets. The other very different option is a day labor. This is something that that you don't see at first sight. But the local street corner stores and so forth actually often hire homeless heroin injectors and crack smokers for a little, what we call just-in-time day labor, to sweep in front of the store, to unload a beer truck that's come through, to, you know, paint the wall or whatever it is. And the whites often entered into these patron-client relationships with the store owners, where the store owner would literally know everything about the addict. They would know how large their heroin addiction was. So they would know that if I give this guy, you know, more than $10, he'll buy too much heroin and be nodding out and be incapable of working for me today. But they knew that if they didn't give him any money, he'd be incapable of working because he'd be throwing up. So they would literally establish these relationships where they would give $10 to, say, promise a guy, I'll give you $10 every morning if you show up at 7 o'clock, and then I'll tell you what I need done today. You know, so they're literally being paid through their addiction. The African Americans, first of all, they didn't have access to those relationships because the store owners didn't trust them for all the same reasons that people are scared in their car of an African American who begs. And also because they also actively rejected it. They said, no, I'm not going to live in slavery to these white or Middle Eastern store owners. I'm a dignified man. I refuse slavery. My ancestors were slaves. And they would criticize the whites for being capable of accepting the humiliation that these store owners would impose on them.
And also, I mean, what would occur is, I mean, there were a few African Americans who did once in a while get one of those relationships, but when they were then sort of treated in this way that they didn't want to be treated, they actually would take something in sort of a weapons of the weak relationship. And then, you know, it would turn on itself, right? So then the store owners would say they do steal. The African Americans would say, you know, we're not stealing, but I'm going to just take the little something because I don't want you treating me that way. And then that cycle would continue. And also what, you know, we were talking about earlier about sort of the differences in injection. So once the whites would inject, they would have abscesses on their bodies. And so you would physically see the differences in the way they carry themselves. And the African Americans wouldn't allow abscesses to be on their bodies because in an abscess, you know, is a big festering a festering wound that is occurring because of a filthy injection. And when they're mainlining, the blood's going to clean out whatever dirt might cause that infection. And so the African Americans aren't going to allow themselves, their bodies, to be, in a sense, polluted physically by this process. And which will just slow them down. And also, it's demeaning to be scarred in such a way physically.
Jeff Schoenberg and Philippe Bourgois are authors of the book Righteous Dope Fiend. It's a photo ethnography. We should emphasize that the photos of Jeff Schoenberg are amazing. There are many, many photos that accompany the text in this book. We have a link to it again on againstthegrain.org. We'll take a short music break and talk more with Philippe and Jeff. Please stay with us. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Erica Bridgman is at the controls today, and we have joining us in our Berkeley studios Jeff Schoenberg. He is a photographer and ethnographer, and he's pursuing graduate studies in a joint UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco Medical Anthropology program. And Philippe Bourgois, who teaches anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. His other books include In Search of Respect and Ethnicity at Work. He also co-edited a volume with Nancy Shepherd Hughes entitled Violence in War and Peace, an anthology. And these two men have put together a photo ethnography entitled Righteous Dope Fiend, published by University of California Press. And again, this documents, in some sense, their more than decade-long getting to know, a process of getting to know and becoming part of the lives of a number of homeless heroin injectors in San Francisco. But it also includes a lot of political analysis and contextual analysis as well. So neoliberalism, you know, this sort of political economic system has been discussed a lot on this program, and there's been a lot of privatization under it, maximization of profits by corporations that roam the globe, deregulation, and certainly healthcare and the field of medicine has been privatized to a large degree. Could one of you talk about what neoliberalism has done specifically to medical care, such that, for example, if one of these homeless people develops a skin abscess, goes in to seek treatment, what kinds of attitudes they encounter, what kinds of deficiencies they might get in terms of healthcare?
Yeah, neoliberalism.
Hold on. Go ahead.
Neoliberalism has resulted in this extraordinarily massive cut in social services. And it's something that we don't even remember well because it's been happening for so long. You know, in some level, you could say that in the United States, the neoliberal model, the way we know it today, got introduced right around with Ronald Reagan, just at the same time that it was being introduced by Margaret Thatcher. The first country that actually consciously introduced neoliberalism, ironically, was Chile. And it basically the Chicago School of Economics at the University of Chicago was the one advancing this. And the idea is you maximize the free market, you minimize social services, and you provide state resources to benefit the market. In some sense, so it's actually ironically a hypocritical thing because you're willing to spend money on law enforcement, you're willing to spend money on wars to protect your markets, but you're not willing to spend money on social services. Now, what's happened with the massive cutbacks in services is that today one of the only places where the indigent destitute can still go to seek a modicum of help is basically to the county hospital emergency room. And simultaneous with that, because of the neoliberal cutbacks, the county hospitals have lost their subsidies. So the county hospitals have had to institute this filtering system to discourage people from coming in. So if you go to the San Francisco General Emergency Room, you're going to sit there a long time. It's going to be a very unpleasant experience. And it'll take many hours for you to get seen by a doctor, if you get seen at all, because the triage nurse might just triage you out and give you some aspirin and throw you out the door. So, and it's not their fault. They're really nice at the San Francisco General. The doctors who work there are really committed to helping the underserved. Otherwise, they could get a job just as well paying on Parnassus Hill at UCSF, where they don't have to see the homeless, because Parnassus, as soon as a homeless person walks in, boom, they throw them and oblige them to go to San Francisco General, our county hospital. So what happens then is that the homeless can't get access to preventative services, and they can't get access even to pretty, you know, desperate services unless they're on the verge of death. Because the policy of the hospital is to discourage people from using the emergency room and therefore to only accept people into the hospital who have life-threatening conditions. And so the homeless would just be logical about it. They would wait until their abscess would become a dangerous
septic condition that's starting to inflame their whole body that would register as a fever, because that would guarantee them that they would get admitted overnight with methadone to control their heroin withdrawal symptoms, and then they would get good treatment in the hospital, because San Francisco General gives great treatment. It's a wonderful institution. We met terrific doctors there, and they literally saved the lives of the members of our network over and over. But what it's become is this perverse relationship where you have to wait till you're literally dying before you get state-of-the-art medical care at extraordinary cost. Some of our guys stayed in the hospital 6 weeks. I mean, think of how much that costs. What is it? $6,000 a day to stay in the ICU? and multiply that by 6 weeks. I mean, that's just a ridiculous way. When this person could have been treated for literally pennies through preventative medicine and through a different way of structuring how he or she could access medical services.
Well, there are some horror stories in your book about, for example, a few doctors who might be so frustrated with the system and maybe so frustrated with sort of what they consider the self-pathologizing behavior of these addicts that they refused certain treatments or medicines. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that to San Francisco General's credit, they changed their policy and no longer allow those kinds of doctors to be treating homeless heroin injectors when they come in for abscesses. It was actually a wonderful experience. We were seeing this systematic mistreatment, because what would happen is that the injectors would come in with an abscess, and they would be, if it was serious enough to get admitted, they would be then given some resident on or a medical student, not even a resident, a medical student on rotation, who they just weren't prepared to see this. And they would get angry. Some of them, the minority of them, would get angry and literally torture the person, refuse them pain medicine and then cut into them and then carve too much and so forth. And we started, Jeff documented this with photographs, basically showing these horrible carvings and people walking around being released from the hospital with no painkiller and this huge gash in their arm.
And you can see the bone. You've seen the picture. Just really horrible. And being sent back out on the street, or having that happen to them without some sort of anesthetic in the process, or putting them into the hospital and then having no idea what's going on with them.
Right.
And so we entered into a relationship with a set of progressive surgeons and discussed this with them. And they instituted a new outpatient clinic that the San Francisco General now has, where they only allow surgeons who like to work with addicts operate on addicts. They only allow nurses who like to work with addicts operate on. And they provide fantastic services, because it takes a certain kind of personality to be able to respect the humanity of an injector. And our guys were bad with institutions. They would, shout and insult the caregivers when they didn't get what they wanted and so forth. But so now there's a good set of services with specialized set of healthcare workers that does a much simpler incision and drain on abscesses, and the addicts are voting with their feet. They're coming in earlier now. Mm-hmm. They know that they can zip in and out, get a simple procedure that's not going to hurt. They're going to be given adequate painkiller, and it won't even scar them as much. And it's costing the whole system less money, because they don't have to spend overnight with a septic condition that puts them at death's door.
And I just want to briefly put into context when this book was going on. So a lot of the field work occurred, most of the field work occurred under a freeway which literally connected, this was during the dot-com boom, and so it literally connected Silicon Valley with the housing and the banks of San Francisco. And so while all this capital is flowing back and forth, I mean, just this incredible amount of capital during this time is flowing back and forth, these guys are literally under the freeway, not going to the hospital when their abscesses are festering, because of whether it's the relationship to the doctor or because of the triage which they're going to experience because of the cuts. And while this book was going on, budget cuts were occurring at San Francisco General. I mean, tremendous budget cuts, and we go into detail of it. But at the same time, revenue in the city of San Francisco was just you know, it was just exploding. I mean, it was incredible.
Jeff Schoenberg and Philippe Bourgois, authors, co-authors of the book Righteous Dope Fiend. We have a link to that on againstthegrain.org. So little time, so much to cover, although, of course, I want to tell listeners we're really only touching the surface of this book, and people ought to get it if they want to learn more about many of these issues. Just a huge question. It's really not fair to ask, but neoliberal economics, what are a couple maybe of the other ways in which the operation of that kind of logic on the ground affects homeless people in terms of housing, in terms of access to other kinds of services? What should we know about just that broader economic context?
The homeless in our setting were basically the generation of working class kids who suffered the massive deindustrialization that took place in the United States following World War II. So their parents and grandparents worked often as unionized laborers in the shipyards, in the steel mills, and all the foundries and so forth supporting the shipyards and steel mills that made San Francisco this extraordinarily rich and dynamic place during World War II. And in the case of the African Americans, their parents literally immigrated from the deep South, where they were often fleeing lynching, fleeing sharecropping, and coming and finding these decent jobs. Those jobs have disappeared. They simply do not exist. And that's because it's cheaper to set up factories abroad where you can pay people less to do the same work. Now, a country that isn't neoliberal, when it's faced with that kind of deindustrialization, because all of the nations in the world, the industrialized nations in the world, basically faced the same dynamic. What they do is very simple. What they do is they institute services to protect the unemployed that are being structurally thrown out of work. In the United States, we don't have those services. So, you know, in France, you get thrown out of your factory, you've got years of unemployment compensation. You've got retraining programs. You've got a whole structure to keep you from hitting the cement and breaking all your teeth. You know, what do we have here? We get a few weeks of unemployment, if we're lucky. And then half the time, the computer system where you log into the unemployment doesn't work because they're saving money and they're trying to keep people from cashing in on their unemployment. So basically, that's, you know, the neoliberalism has exacerbated, it's worsened the structural forces that have hurt all the industrialized nations. And it hasn't, we haven't retrained our working class industrial refugees in some sense.
Yeah, and among many other things, as you indicate in this book, it's taken money away from public housing and affordable housing. I mean, it's done so much to essentially throw people out on the street without
Right, it leads to gentrification. I mean, gentrification is the classic neoliberal phenomenon because you allow the free market of housing to take over, and boom, what happens? It goes to the highest bidder. You know, housing should not be run on a free market. That leads to massive homelessness. In the rest of the industrialized nations, it's not a free market for housing. There's all kinds of state controls and subsidies, and massive proportions of the European population live in subsidized housing.
But there is subsidies, the subsidization of, say, of mortgage costs, right?
Yeah, right. Ironically, the subsidy goes to the wealthy.
The subsidy goes to those who are then able to purchase those homes, which are then able to displace people.
Yeah, you take a tax deduction on your
absolutely
mortgage. That's the irony.
I think among the policy reforms that you do suggest, and you know, all the while indicating that there's a much bigger system that has to be addressed, but among the specific policy reforms you suggest that you recommend is actually heroin prescription, which might strike people as a little weird that you would prescribe heroin to heroin addicts. Briefly, since we're sort of running out of time, how would that work? And how does that work, say, in other countries?
Yeah. Switzerland is the nation that has instituted what they call diversified opiate prescription, which is essentially providing heroin to long-term addicts. And what they found is the results are very good. The person who in the past was very destructive, was stealing, was beating up members of their family, was cutting themselves up with abscesses and so forth, all of a sudden becomes basically this relatively obedient patient coming in on time for their pure heroin. And they literally discuss with I visited the Swiss prescription clinics. It's an extraordinary thing to see. They're given this liquid heroin that's just white. It looks like water. It's so pure. It just looks like they're injecting water. And then they're obliged to sit there to make sure they don't overdose, and then they leave. And these guys are, you know, guys with tattoos on both sides of their face. These are the equivalent of the righteous dope fiends in the United States, people that are committed to their heroin. And the Swiss have just decided it causes less suffering, it causes less violence, and, you know, it's insane to be beating people up, throwing them in jail, and turning them into even angrier and more destructive individuals. And now Germany has instituted it as a pilot program. Canada has a pilot program. Spain has a pilot program. Throughout Europe, they're starting to institute pilot programs of diversified opiate.
2 minutes left. What other kinds of public outreach would you like to do in addition to writing this book and educating readers?
Well, our latest project is an exhibit at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology. What Jeff managed to do is transfers photographs onto these metal plates, and then we then boiled down our text so that the viewer gets this experience of homelessness that's both artistic, visual, and also has the analysis. And then we piped in audio as well, taking from our recordings voices from the homeless. We're actually trying to get that to come to a museum in San Francisco. If any of the listeners have an idea, send us an email because this is where the show should be showing.
And it brings in, obviously, it brings in a different audience who might go in and read
an academic press book.
And also, I mean, because the book itself, we are trying to integrate the photos with the field notes, which are more sort of testimonial, as well the analysis. And the show does that. But it's a very, obviously, a different experience, because when you look at a book, you don't guarantee, obviously, that you're going to read the text. You might just look at the photos.
Sure.
And I definitely have fear that, you know, when you look at these photos and seeing them out of context of what's going on, it could promote, you know, bad feelings towards the people in there, as opposed to, you know, sort of the progressive agenda that we might have. Mm-hmm.
Well, if anybody has a museum in mind, a local museum, they should contact Philippe. We have a link, by the way, on againstthegrain.org to Philippe's faculty page at the University of Pennsylvania. Their book is Righteous Dope Fiend. The authors are Jeff Schoenberg and Philippe Bourgois. More information on our website. Thank you both so much for writing this book and for joining me.
Thank you.
We both love your show.
Yeah, this is great. Absolutely.
It's been an honor for me. This is Sia suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio. And I hear it's the most reliable way to sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. And we are also on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who is at the controls today.